Gina Martin is a household name in England for forcing a legal change which made upskirting a crime. That's taking photographs up women's skirts and sharing the photos, essentially. It happened to her. She became an activist. She changed the law. She's written a book too called Be the Change, a toolkit for the activist in you. It's basically about what she learnt in the course of the gruelling campaign. She explains how it all began.
So in July 2017, I was at a festival with my sister waiting to see the Killers come on stage. It's just a kind of one day festival we have in London. It's really expensive. It's about £90 to go for the day. And we forked out the cash and went down, and it was broad daylight. It was about 6 p.m. We were standing in a crowd of about 60,000 people, and these guys started hitting on me, and that continued for about, well, I don't know, half an hour. And I said no about as many times as I could before getting angry. And then, without me knowing, one of them stuck his hands between my legs and took photos up my skirt of my crotch without me knowing. And I didn't see him do it, but then I saw another guy, big blonde guy who was in this group. There was about eight of them. I saw him looking on his phone, and I looked around the back of him, and he had WhatsApp open, and he'd been sent a photo, the photo of my crotch. And I grabbed the phone and kind of held it up, and we got into a scuffle, and then I ran away through the crowd to the security. They called the police. I had the phone with me, and he was chasing me. And then when I handed the phone over to the police, they said, you know, you should be able to go to a festival in 30 degrees and not have this happen to you. But we've looked at the photo, and although it shows more than you want it to, there's nothing we can really do about it. And that's kind of all you'll hear from us. And I left the festival and went home that night and got really angry about it. And I looked into the law and found out that upskirting had been a sexual offence in Scotland and various countries around the world.
Including New Zealand, actually.
Yeah, was it 2006 you guys did it?
Yeah, 2005, 2006, something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people had done this, and we hadn't done it. And once I looked into what was happening, it was happening in schools. Teachers were doing it to their students and stuff. It was like a real big problem.
Teachers were doing it to the students?
Yeah, there was a teacher in Croydon, South London, who they found 5,000 photos on his phone of, you know, young seven-year-old girls. His students, who he's been teaching for years, and they couldn't prosecute him. So I started a campaign to change the law, and that's where it all really began. And that was about 18 months long.
I think what really, really made you angry was that you put a photo of these guys up on Facebook. And what happened after that had been up for a few days?
Yeah. So I put this photo up. Me and Stevie had taken like a selfie, and they were in the back of it before, by chance, before they'd done it to me. And we put it on Facebook, and then it went a little bit viral. I asked a whole bunch of people to share it. I think it got a couple of...
What did you say? These were the guys who upskirted me.
Yeah, I just circled their faces, and I think I was just kind of at a loss that the law couldn't help me and the police couldn't help me. So I just kind of said, does anyone recognise these guys? I want them to feel something for what they've done. I was so humiliated. And Facebook got in contact with me after a couple of days and told me that I'd violated their community service guidelines and that it was harassment what I'd done to them, and I needed to take the photo down. And that's when I got really angry, because I was like, they have photos of my crotch still and nothing can be done, but a photo of their faces online is harassment. That can't be right, you know? And that's when I started the campaign really online.
Did you have an idea in your mind of exactly what you wanted to do, or was it just anger that was fueling you at that point?
At that point, it was just anger. At that point, I knew the power of social media because I'd worked in advertising for 7 years or 6 years at that point. So really, I just wanted to shout about an issue and ask why it wasn't a sexual offence, and open up a bigger conversation about the way that we feel entitled to women's bodies and marginalised genders' bodies and how we treat them. And I really just want to start that conversation. But it wasn't until about 2 months in or a month in when the response was so huge. And this was, bearing in mind, this was about 6 months before Me Too. We had kind of a mini Me Too happen with this campaign where thousands of people were telling stories of being upskirted or photos taken of them and all this kind of stuff. And when that happened, that's when I realised, okay, I'm angry about this and I'm shouting about an issue, but I need to get organised here and get a lawyer and get really strategic if I'm actually going to change anything and not just shout about it.
You had lots of supporters, yeah. Did you have haters as well?
Yes. Yeah, I had rape threats for about a year and a half online, and it's just, you know, I became a meme at one point, and just photos of me going around with guys tagging their friends in and people asking to see the photo, and I was getting emails to my personal account and messages to every account under the sun from people saying that I deserved for it to happen because I was wearing a skirt and slut shaming and very graphic threats for a long time.
You deserved for it to be happen because you were wearing a skirt?
Yeah, see, this is what happens. As soon as we discuss sexual assault or sexual violence...
You were asking for it. You must have been asking for it.
Exactly. We slut shame and we really victim blame in a huge way in society, and that's something we really have to address. That conversation has to change.
Tell me this. Were the haters all men or were there some women also?
They were pretty much exclusively men. There was a couple of... There was a few older women who were angry at me just because I think they were fighting for fundamental rights and they think that these kinds of things are not as important and they think we should be fighting for different things, but they weren't threatening. They were more angry debate, really, I guess, but most of the threat, well, yeah, all of the threats were men, unfortunately.
Yeah. So you got loads of support and you ended up collaborating with a lawyer who decided to help you pro bono. How did you get in touch with him?
Yes, so Ryan Whelan, he was my lawyer and is now my great friend. I basically
great being the appropriate word. He's like 700 feet tall, isn't he?
I know, he's like a beast. He's a complete beast. He's brilliant. I basically did the social media campaign for 2 months and I started doing traditional media, so TV and radio and doing kind of debates on TV and stuff. And I'd packaged up the numbers from social media and said, look how many people are interested in this becoming a sexual offence. And therefore I did TV with that. And after I did that, I basically started emailing law firms and saying, do you do pro bono representation? I worked with a law student that I knew from university who looked into the law with me and said, yeah, you're absolutely right about this. And then I just basically knocked on doors. And really, what activism is it?
You mean literally knocked on doors?
Well, I guess pinged in emails would be
right. That's right. I thought it might be a kind of social media euphemism. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just sent about probably 4,000 emails. And really, that's what activism is, I think, really. Whether or not I was in Parliament, whether I was in the government working with them, whether I was trying to get a lawyer, it's really agitating and asking questions until people let you in the room. And I spent a lot of time trying to get a lawyer. And I talked to a few, a lot of them, it was kind of an ego trip. A lot of people were like, oh, yeah, I've wanted to change this for ages. And I met with Ryan and he was just like, this is your thing. You've done great work so far. Whatever I can do to help. And I met with him and we sat there for 3 hours and he became a great friend. And just the two of us took on the government together in the end. And he's a genius. He will be prime minister one day, I'm sure.
Well, you're certainly in need of one, right?
Oh, big time, big time.
Tell me this. Why was it legal? Why was it not illegal in England and Wales and yet had been illegal in Scotland for so long?
I've tried to answer that question and work that out myself for a long time, and there really isn't one simple answer. I think one problem we have is that there's a long way to go for people to understand how social media is used and how camera phones and technology is used as a weapon for what has been a very, very long fight about entitlement to women's bodies and marginalized genders' bodies. That's a conversation we've been having for a long time, but social media and technology has been used as a new weapon there. And I think in what can be archaic industries like law and politics, they really haven't caught up with that and they don't really understand how it's used. There was a gap in the law. We had an old common law called outraging public decency that was already in place, but that was written about 100 years ago. And basically what that did was, it said, it was what we charged for people if they kind of urinated at a festival. It said that the public had to see something lewd, but it completely disregarded that this was a victim with a crime. So there was one law there, but it was kind of slapping a public nuisance order on a sexual offence and it didn't really work. I really think they just hadn't got around to closing up the gap because they hadn't understood the power of technology yet and the law was kind of lagging behind there.
The law then on upskirting seemed to be on the verge of being passed last year. You got the support of a Lib Dem MP and she put forward a private members bill. But in the case of a private members bill in the UK, House of Commons, it only takes one vote against it to dash it.
And
A Tory MP called Sir Christopher Chope voted against the law on upskirting. Why did he do that?
That was a really interesting experience because me and Ryan were there for every single level of the bill. And the day that he objected, we had just secured government backing for the campaign that morning.
I mean, it seemed like nothing could go wrong. People were reporting exactly. that the law was about to be passed, no problem.
Of course, because in this age of Me Too and in this progressive age, you know, who would go on public TV and say no to protecting young girls and women? Like, we didn't expect anyone to do that. But we found out about 3 days before that he was going to. But on the morning of him objecting, we also found out that the government had backed the bill, probably because they knew he was going to object and they wanted to help. So I had to do a whole day of celebratory victory media, knowing that he was going to object at 3 p.m. and I was going to be in the house humiliated pretty much. We went in, he objected. When we came out, he was there. And I went over to him and said, Christopher Chope, I wanted to meet you and ask you why you objected to the bill. And he said, which one? Because he objected to many. It's become a habit for him, really. And I said, oh, it was the upskirting bill. And he said, who are you? And I said, I'm the activist that got it through. I'm the person, a victim of it, really. And he said, oh, I haven't read it. And I said, oh, okay, you haven't read the bill you've objected to. And he said, no, I don't read them. And I offered to meet with him and educate him on what upskirting was because I said this bill was really important to people. And his reason for objecting was he said that he doesn't he doesn't like bills going through on a Friday without discussion and without debate. But if he hadn't objected to that bill, it would have gone through 10 stages of debate. So that doesn't really hold water. What I think is that he really doesn't like young, non-political people from outside the house coming in and getting a bill through super, super fast when he has kind of 25 he's trying to get through. But in the end, we went around him and me and Ryan the next day, we went straight to the Ministry of Justice and we met with them and we said, we want to table a government bill because it goes above all the MPs' heads and no one can object to it and let's get this done as fast as possible. The public had kicked off. His office got trashed with knickers inside Parliament and his constituency. And I think they were ready to help, which is why they backed it the day before. And they turned around and said, OK, yeah, we'll table a new bill. And that's what me and Ryan and the government saw through for the last 18 months.
I'm talking to Gina Martin, who managed to get upskirting made a crime in England and Wales. Did you get everything you wanted in the law?
Yes, me and Ryan wrote the new legislation. So it went through as we wrote it without any major amendments. So it was exactly what we hoped for. It really couldn't have been a better outcome, I don't think.
I think you wanted, did you not want offenders put on a sex offenders register?
Yes, and that's what will happen with it. So
is that right?
So it's the Sexual Offences Act 2003, which is already in place, which was obviously put in place in 2003. And then we amended that. So we added upskirting to it. And that means that there's a range of punishments. So from fines to the sex offenders register, all the way up to 2 years in prison, which would be what Andrew Cornish, the teacher who took thousands of photos of kids, he would get that. He would get sexual offenders register and in prison, whereas before nothing would happen to him. So there's a whole range of punishments and it's a very, very progressive law. It's a gender neutral law that we wrote. It protects everyone. There is a big issue with upskirting with trans people's bodies because there's a very big morbid fascination of what they look like, what their bodies look like, which is no one's business. And we really spent time writing this law and making it progressive. So it's as we hoped. And I really hope it will help a lot of people. There's already been some people arrested and looking to be charged under it in England now, which was a massive day for me. It was huge to see
have
that.
I was going to ask you early days, but any prosecutions yet?
Just arrests at this point and in the process of looking into prosecution. But they're taking, generally, we're taking upskirting a huge, huge lot more serious here. Like, we didn't even talk about it before the campaign. And on the underground and on public transport, the amount of news stories that have come out since the campaign of the police calling out and looking for the public to help them find these guys is huge. So I'm really proud of that as well, because a law doesn't necessarily change minds, but education does and conversation does. And that's what we seem to be doing as well. So it's really great.
You've quit your job, have you, to become a full-time writer and activist? You just brought a book out called Be the Change. What else are you going to do?
There's a whole lot of stuff I want to do. I think we all feel a bit like that. I feel a bit paralysed by the amount of things I want to get involved
You're
in.
You're not a single issue activist.
No, I mean, I am. When I set my mind to a project, that's all I kind of do, waking moment to sleeping. But there's so many things going on at the moment I want to get involved with, and it's really focusing my energy. But right now, I think it's really important for me to really make activism accessible to people. I've been going into schools and talking to kids and in charities about why they should get into civil action, why they should help the governments, why they should do more than just vote, that's the least we should be doing, and how they can make change in their communities and in their street, in their schools, in their work. Because when I started this work, I could only really find kind of very academic texts about activism and things that made me feel like I wasn't going to be able to do it. And it takes a remarkable person to do this, and I'm not a remarkable person. I'm, you know, very average academically, just got a lot of passion. So I really wanted to go to schools and talk to kids about this, which is what I'm doing. And then I'm going to be doing quite a lot of broadcasting to help people get their stories out about how they're changing things and to help people finish what they started as well. And I've started researching my next campaign for next year as well. So it's all go, but it's all very exciting.
What is it?
I can't say yet because everyone knows who I am now, so it's harder to like pop up and sneak out and into little places and make powerful people angry if everyone knows I'm going to do it.
Had you been an activist before?
No, I'd always kind of done small acts of good. I think, like, I used to live in Greece and I campaigned and raised money and saved this stray dog from this pack I looked after in Greece when I worked on boats, and brought him to the UK and found him a home and stuff. So I've always kind of done stuff because I just care about people and I care about the world and I believe the best in people, and I really think we can all make change every day if we want to. So I've done that, but I would never call myself an activist until, I guess, when you change a law, you have to give yourself a name, otherwise you can't explain your job very easily.
So can I take a guess and suggest that your next campaign will also be gender related or not?
No, my next campaign will be, if I say the most pressing issue that's facing our world right now, it's something to do with that. So it is something to do with
Boris Johnson.
Yes, you got it in one.
I knew it. Your book stresses that anyone can be the change. Was that a doubt in your mind to begin with?
Oh yeah, massively. I don't think anyone goes into, I mean, at the basis of it, activism and trying to change things is kind of, you have to go against the status quo in some way to do that. If the formal procedures don't let you do that, you have to go against them in some way. And it's not easy to do that. And you end up in situations that you really don't feel like you belong in. Like, I never felt comfortable in Parliament. I'm a working class Scouse family girl from Liverpool. I just didn't feel very comfortable there, and I felt really out of my depth a lot of the time, and I was taking on something I'd never done before. So I was learning every day and throwing stuff at the wall and seeing if it stuck and working out what I was doing as I went. So it's a really scary place to be in. So any, you know, you will feel out your depth, you will struggle if you do activism, but also there's nothing more illuminating and there's nothing more empowering than taking on a problem and trying to solve it for people. And you end up meeting the community I'm in now of people who are trying to change things in London. It's just, it makes it easier to sleep at night because you just meet wonderful people who are trying to change the world for the better every single day.
Can you imagine can you imagine a world without social media?
Not now. I remember it, but I can't imagine it now. I think it's
because
that's the key, right?
You know, hashtagism.
There's a huge key, and it gets a really bad rap, and rightly so a lot of the time, but it really is up to us to be using it for better and to be using it for good. And if you have a laptop and a bedroom, you can achieve far more and far quickly and motivate people in a way you just couldn't before. So social media is a massive tool that we can use for good, for sure.
It gets a bad rap, rightly so, because, you know, where was your crotch shot going to end up? But
exactly.
A lot of people call themselves activists by just kind of clicking on the like button. Do you suggest that people need to do more than that?
I do. I talk about this in my book. Social media is democratized activism. So in the way that when I put a petition up, even though I was going into Parliament, I needed, you know, Dave from Rotherham to click on that petition and maybe not leave his seat because he's not prepared to do anymore, or he struggled to do anymore, or he's not out in the community and he doesn't have the resources and the access. So it has made it easier for a lot of people, and we still need those people to click the petitions, to share the articles, to do that. But my belief is that that should be the least that you can, that you do if you have the opportunity, and that it should always be online and offline. That's when a campaign really becomes rich and comes into its own, when it also leaves the computer as well as thrives on it.
I think you've already inspired, well, others, I have no doubt, but specifically a German woman to do the same with the upskirting law there, yeah?
Yeah, I'm really proud. There's two wonderful girls who are working really hard on a campaign that basically they started. We've been talking on Instagram. I've been trying to kind of help them out with some advice and stuff, because they started it when they saw my campaign. And that's exactly what I hoped would happen. In Gibraltar, they passed a law as well to make upskirting illegal. In France, they followed suit and are in the process of it. And then now we have young activists in Germany who are trying to do the same thing. And that's really what activism should be doing as well. I think often people ask me, okay, how do I do what you did, which I can understand that question, and I get that a lot. But also, even if you can't finish the thing you started, even if it gets too hard or you need to look after yourself and take time away from it, by putting the effort in, you always open doors to other people. And that's really huge. That's really positive. So I'm really excited about that. I'm going to keep an eye on Germany closely and see how they do.
When were you first aware of upskirting, Gina?
I saw it on the corner, like a dark, like an advertising porn site when I was like 12, when I was on the internet at my house. An ad came up and I clicked on the ad, and I saw on the side of the ad, on the kind of bar at the side, these videos taking up women's skirts at the till of shops in America. And I remember reading the copy, and it said that they were creep shots, like they didn't know that they were happening. So I always knew it was kind of the seedy side of the internet, and also non-consensual photographs and non-consensual sexualization of women is a huge problem. And that's kind of a massive part of porn, which is very odd anyway. But then when I when this happened to me and I started this campaign, that's when I really understood that this is kind of an everyday, quote unquote, assault that's happening a lot. And it's really, you know, moved from porn into the real world.
It's kind of a technical question here, but is there a special appliance that they have on the phones, or they just how does it work?
It's really interesting. There's through the ages, it's kind of, you've seen the evolution of it, and because I've done so much research onto it. So in school, before cameras, people used to use mirrors. So my auntie remembers a guy using a mirror, like a boy in her school that was her age, using a mirror on his shoe. So that's kind of upskirting. And then it turned into small cameras. When it's done professionally, there's hidden cameras, basically they're in the floor. A guy did it on the underground in a pen when he was holding a pen. Another guy had it on the bottom pocket of his backpack, a hidden camera. Obviously iPhones make it really easy. There's also selfie sticks that make it incredibly easy. But in Japan, the actual design of phones has been altered now. So you can't turn off the sound of the camera shutter, because it happens so much on the tube that they want to alert women it's happened to them. So you actually can't mute a camera on a camera phone now in Japan. So people are really becoming aware to it, but we need to be coming up with solutions that fix the root of the problem and not just alerting women that it's already happened, I think.
Good Lord, you've become a complete expert on upskirting.
Yeah, I have. I really have.
Wow. How are you going to make a living if you've quit your job?
Well, I'm a writer as well, so I write a lot for lots of different publications. So I write for Vogue and World Economic Forum and The Telegraph and lots of newspapers here. I also do a lot of speaking jobs where I go and educate and talk to kids and speak truth to power as well in lots of amazing situations, privileged places to be in. And I go back to Parliament and do panels and stuff. So I'm paid for speaking, I'm paid for writing. And now I also work with brands who are doing good. So I guess the original influencer model, where you would work and get paid to wear a t-shirt, I'll generally work with kind of one out of every 50 person who comes to me who's doing an interesting campaign, and I'll help them bring that campaign to life as well. So I'm paid by brands, but I really have to do the paid work so I can do the campaigning, because campaigning is pretty expensive and you don't get paid for it, but it really is the thing I love the most. So doing the paid work really helps me continue that work for sure.
This activist is quite a brand, you know, and I think that you've said that one of the problems is that as soon as you stand for something, you're expected to stand for everything.
Oh, yes, I am. I get that a lot. And especially with social media, like, as soon as you say you care about something, then you have to be this kind of perfect kind of person who does everything right and never puts a foot out of place. But I've always, since the beginning of this work, talked about the fact that I'm a regular person who's just really angry about something and tried really, really hard to change it and didn't even know if I'd be able to finish it. And my book talks that a lot about that, about how I'm learning every day and the learning is never really done. And it's kind of up to all of us to not put people on pedestals, but to continue the work and get involved and treat people like humans, because we're so used to the celebrity model, but a lot of the people we look up to now are really regular people. So I'm very vocal about that and about the fact that I'm imperfect and that most of the people we follow are. And I think that's a healthier way to look at it and a healthier way to use social media.
In your next campaign, I mean, you know, I'm kind of hazard a guess that it's going to be something to do with climate change. But when you launch a campaign, do you need to have a target that is achievable? For example, with the upskirting thing, you got a law. With climate change, what do you get? It's so big.
It is so big. This is the really important thing I talk about with the campaign. A law is such a massive thing. It's such a huge thing to change a law, and I objectively see that. But if we look at what I did, I kind of took a big issue. Basically, I took sexual violence and then distilled it down to one small part of it, which was upskirting. And I talk in my book a lot about how to find the thing that you care about and distill it down. We have people who, you know, the 5p bag tax, for instance, we have here. So you can't get a plastic bag unless you pay 5p. And now 80% of plastic bags in supermarkets, people don't use anymore. That's a very small, achievable thing in a bigger, more difficult problem. And that's when activism works really well, is when all different types of people take on all different types of small issues and we kind of put a puzzle piece down at the same time. So the next campaign will be a part of the big problem, which is climate change, like you said, climate breakdown. But it really is about finding an achievable goal, and it's about setting the end goal and then working backwards and breaking it up really into bite-sized chunks. So for me, it was like, right, get a lawyer. That's the first thing. Don't think about anything else. When you've got a lawyer, set out a strategy. Don't think about anything else, because activism can be overwhelming. So you really have to take it one step at a time.
Do you think that you've changed? I mean, you've obviously, you're a very confident person. You're a very hands-on person. Do you think that this has changed you, though?
Yes, I think it probably has. It's made me more confident. I've always been a very passionate person, very loud person. I always thought I was a bit odd in school, it's a bit too loud, a bit too excitable. And it's given me a real amazing place to put all that energy. But it's really helped me develop my identity. It's really helped me learn so much as well. Like, I've learned so much about society, about different communities, about people. I have this thirst for that knowledge now that before I would have felt probably embarrassed about caring so much about stuff. Now I feel like I'm allowed to, and I'm really excited about learning. So it's given me a huge amount of confidence, and it's taught me so much about the world. And I think it's really just given me the permission to not ask for permission anymore. I think I used to think, okay, I can't really do this or rock the boat or whatever. But the truth is, no one's going to ever give you permission to rock the boat. That's never going to happen. And now I'm really excited and confident, and I know a lot more than I did. So I think it's really changed me. It's given me the biggest purpose I've ever had in my life, I think.
That's Gina Martin, whose book's called Be the Change, A Toolkit for the Activist in You.